That's one of the finest quartets you could ever find. Ron Cotter on bass and the leader, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Sir Roland Hanna on piano, and Billy Cobham on drums, with Miles Davis's 1959 extraordinary composition, All Blues. This is a title track from Carter's 1973 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and what a way to start the week. In the second half of our program today, we will remember the Titan, Muhammad Ali, the renowned boxer and humanitarian who died on June the 3rd at a Phoenix area hospital where he was being treated for respiratory complications associated with his 32-year battle with Parkinson's disease. He was 74 years old. We will remember him in the second half of the program. But first, we go to Baltimore and we get prepped for what is about to happen in Baltimore, and that is the trial of the third officer, Officer Caesar Goodson, the police officer facing the most serious charges in the death of Freddie Gray on April the 12th last year. There is a court hearing today to determine what will end up as being evidence in his trial, which begins in earnest, at least so far scheduled, for tomorrow. But our guest, Attorney Alton Maddox, disassembles for us the state attorney's case, the handling of this case, which has yielded so far an acquittal for Officer Edward Nero 2 weeks ago in a non-jury trial, and a mistrial last December in the case of Officer William Porter. Alton, thank you. It is always a pleasure to have you with us. It's always an education. We are, of course, going to come back to this case as the trial begins in earnest, but I wanted us to get an appreciation from you, from a legal expert's opinion, as to what is happening in this case and what sense do you make of this third prosecution so far. The score is 0-2, and this is the third attempt by the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, for something of a conviction coming out of this case. But thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, Eutrice, and I want to start off by saying that I wrote an announcement earlier in which I said that you and I had really gone full circle, and that, you know, actually, this is really 30 years later. But what is important is that we are, you know, on the verge of going back to Howard Beach again with respect to what happened here in Staten Island. And, you know, you and I really start as dance partners 30 years ago.
That's true. I didn't think of it that way, but that is quite true. 30 years ago.
Right. And so, you know, it's full circle. And it's just so interesting because, really, I tell you, the reality of it is that based on what has really happened this week, from Baltimore to Staten Island to Howard Beach to Louisville, Kentucky, and all of that, it would probably just take a whole week to really go over it because it has really come full circle in so many different ways. And that is what is so interesting, how things have really converged together in a way that may give some meaning to what all this has really been about and what it might be about in the future. But in starting off with Freddie Gray, let me say that when a client comes into the office, you really don't have to ask the person anything about what happened because you can really look at the indictment and it tells you everything that you really need to know if you know how to carefully read an indictment. And right from the outset, you know, when we started talking about an accusatory instrument, at the top is the caption of the case. And that's really where we started the last time, where we said that not only is it important to read the caption, but also to understand what it says. And one of the very, very big tip-offs when we talked about it the last time was the fact that the lead defendant was not the the police officer who was the supervisor, Rice, but some lower individuals in the chain of command. And so from there, you know, we basically said that most of this case would be very difficult to prove just by the way that the defendants were arraigned in terms of the indictment. And so far, you know, that has really proven to be true because, as you know now, one defendant has been acquitted, one defendant had a mistrial, and now you have the third defendant who is seeking a bench trial as opposed to a jury trial. And one thing that's very interesting in that lineup is the fact that, and I said this right from the beginning, that there comes a time when people must understand that when you look at the caption of the case, it's about a class and not a family. And that's where we take off wrong, because we give so much credence to the family that we dismiss the fact that it's really a class action. And that many times in a class action, you have to intervene in order to make sure there is justice. And one thing that we had said that we should be an application for the motion to intervene, in which, you know, we basically said that there was very necessary for the whole community to be involved. And as you look at the case today with Goodson, that begins to ring true, because the most important thing as far as Goodson is concerned is the fact that his other comrade had a bench trial, and the result was favorable to the comrade. And therefore, you know, Goodson is expecting that the result will be somewhat very much similar to him, and that might be true. And the reason why an intervention is necessary, and why, you know, it's not done that way normally. But when you practice the law, you can't do things in the traditional way. And therefore, the argument that the community may want to argue here, and one which would apply to us here in New York as well, is the fact that while the defendant may have a constitutional right to a jury trial, no defendant has a right to a bench trial. And, you know, that needs to be litigated in the sense of saying that ultimately the people must decide whether this particular defendant's conduct is culpable enough for him or her to be punished. And that may not be the case where there is a bench trial. And so we really coming back to basically some of the very same propositions that we asserted when we first started to tackle this particular case.
Well, here we have a series of interconnecting problems here, legal problems, and the most glaring, I would suggest, is what appears to be the inexperience, if you will, of the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, to deal with the complexity of this case, and in effect yielding her authority over it to sympathetic parts of the process, mostly the court. We had the judge in the case making very important decisions as to settle certain questions about whether, for example, a police officer's testimony could be used against other police officers. These things, I imagined, would have been anticipated by a state's attorney and would have, the case, therefore, would have been situated very differently from the very beginning, considering that she had not just one, but six defendants in this case. And certain issues should never have come up to the point where they impede the prosecution, a successful prosecution of this case. But the fact that so many issues have arisen that cause the court now to be the intervening factor and the court to be making decisions that will now reposition the case and reposition the defendants in the case suggests to me that, you know, she just didn't have a handle on this thing. How does it look to you?
Well, I think the problem is that, one, you know, everything that you said is true, but it doesn't really, you know, cancel out for the fact that in a case so serious as this, the prosecution alone should be left to deciding the outcome of a case. And the reason I say that, because, you know, when you look at the legal history of the United States, there are times when there are agencies in certain venues where they don't really have a prosecutor. And so, you know, I know North Carolina was one of the last ones that I remember when we were dealing with the Joanne Little case, a case which dealt with a black woman inmate in a jail cell and being raped by this white man. And she took matters into her own hands, literally, and stopped the rape from happening or ended his life. And so, you know, North Carolina actually permitted at that particular time for cases to be prosecuted by the family itself. So I don't think that the fact that that we, in most cases, now have the professional offices should do away with the fact that there are times when something other than a professional office or something in addition to a professional office should be employed. And I believe clearly in this case that would be the situation, and one in which if the community wanted to argue that she was inexperienced, then I think that would be something that the judge would have to consider, and at least the community would have that on the record before it went further into the case. And so, you know, I don't think what you're saying is anything inconsistent with what I'm saying. I just think that, you know, there's just different ways of saying it. But I think the result would be the same even if we employ your line of thinking or if you employ my line of thinking.
The discussion today in court and in the preliminary hearing has to do with the testimony that would be allowed in court from other officers relating to the conduct of Caesar Goodson, who was a driver of the van in which Freddie Gray suffered these fatal injuries while being transported to be processed at a police station. What could you tell us, in your view, right as this process begins, and leading directly into tomorrow's start of trial, what do you expect the focus of that discussion to be today?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the first thing, you know, is the issue in terms of the credibility of the evidence, and relating to the credibility of the evidence would be one in which there is some evidence because of other relationships might not be included or might be excluded from the trial process. And so basically, you know, the party would enter and basically, you know, say, look, this is what the expected testimony is. And, you know, we think that because of these certain relationships, one way or the other, that may have an impact, because you got to not only consider the fact that there's going to be evidence in chief in terms of those cases, but you have to also consider the fact that there's going to be some credibility questions that might be raised as to the reliability of the evidence. And so, you know, the judge then had to look at these various fact patterns and these various relationships to determine what should be relied upon and what should be excluded.
Well, to start that discussion, though, we have a counter discussion in a way, in that Goodson appears to be the only officer who was, in one way or the other, able to monitor what was happening in that van, because he was the driver of the van, and other officers were not consistently for the entire period that Freddie Gray was being transported from the point of arrest to the point of processing at the police station. So this puts William Porter, from a defense point of view, in a pretty good position, because there's nothing, no one really, no eyewitness as such to contradict anything that he's saying.
Well, that's true. And the other hidden factor here is the fact that the supervising police officer, in the testimony that, you know, that one way or another he may want to offer, you know, may also be helpful or harmful. But especially when you consider the fact that you don't have him at this particular time as a prosecution witness, then, you know, the question would become whether that testimony would be reliable. And then, two, the question is whether this particular Goodson would be coerced to incriminate himself in order to offer a defense. And, you know, and I think that basically when you begin to look at the different relationships, as I said from the beginning, you know, then you really start really zero in on the problems in terms of the quality of the evidence that could be produced in order to bring about a conviction.
But either way, as of tomorrow, 50% of this case will have been tackled legally, and in short order, one would presume it would also be resolved legally, one way or the other. So far, we look at the score points. We've had two officers already tried, no convictions in either case. Goodson is the third, and we have a disturbing situation in which we don't see ironclad proof against him, and we can only conjecture that unless the judge is relied upon heavily in this case to be the sole arbiter of the facts, it looks like Goodson, under a very strenuous defense, can actually fend off these charges, the most serious of the charges. So with 50% of the case done as of the trial of Goodson, what emerges for you as an experienced attorney, an experienced defense attorney, and one who has dealt with police brutality cases and police killings, and cases in which you have successfully, the only attorney in the country, succeeding in getting appointed a special prosecutor in cases like this, what do you see already emerging as a systemic problem that could serve as a pattern or a patent for future prosecutions of police officers in cases like this?
Well, I think, one, you know, when you look at this particular case, you know, the question, as you indicate, is like a chess match where you have to be able to foresee in advance certain strategic moves that have to be made. And so, you know, in a case like this, I reckon the first question that would come to mind as to why she chose to maybe try this case with individual defendants as opposed to trying them in a way that they were involved in the transaction, and that is as a gang. And so I think that when she go back over and look at this case, she has to think about that particular strategy of actually separating defendants, because, you know, unless there's a motion of severance, you know, generally, in cases like this, you know, they prefer to try them as a group. And usually it is the defense that makes the application for severance, deciding certain problems that they see in advance. So in many ways, I think that she has done in a very smooth way, a good way of actually exonerating these defendants, because to the extent that she may have had a shot against them, she chose to take up that burden herself rather than for the defendant to have to scramble for cover.
The other piece has to do with the interventive, or I would say the intermediary role here, and the mediation role of the court, it seems to me, in deciding how these cases against the officers are to be framed. And I find that unusual, the inordinate weight of the court in framing the prosecution's case and or amending the thrust of the prosecution's case.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and like you said, then that really goes back to, again, the point that you raised, and that would be the lack of skill or ability of the prosecution. But that's one thing that should have been presented to the court in advance. You know, I mean, if they felt that that was something that would help them, because I don't think they wanted to. I think they were all in agreement that the way that she had proceeded, you know, would actually help them. I don't see anything that she had done other than the big splash she made at the outset of the trial, that it looked like she was going to conduct a preemptive strike. But I don't see anything that she had done that would in any way be harmful to these police officers. I mean, because there's always going to be some attendant risk to any particular prosecution. But, you know, when you're not really pushing defendants up against the wall and make them sweat, you know, I think they move from a very comfortable position of actually getting out of the matter, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, and you have to be very realistic about this. I mean, most people are very reluctant to convict a police officer in the first place. And so, you know, with that in mind, you know, I don't think that she has done anything that would make anybody sweat in this particular case.
And that includes perhaps the charge of second-degree depraved heart murder, manslaughter, assault, misconduct in office, and reckless endangerment charges. It seems to me that in the middle of all of this, you have to have somebody, some person or persons, who would testify and absolutely conclude or help the jury conclude that, yes, this was an intentional act. But we don't see the basis here, at least I don't see an ironclad case that anybody, in the absence of eyewitnesses and eyewitness testimony that could prove the severity of these charges and a conviction resulting from them.
Well, you know, because you're right in the sense that I haven't seen any real focus on scientific evidence that may possibly be a smoking gun in a case like this. And I haven't seen any demonstration that what the police officer did would be so egregious that somebody would be urged to convict in these particular cases. And that's the problem when you don't have a real smoking gun. I mean, you have a death, but you don't have a real smoking gun. And, you know, obviously, on one hand, you got the community expecting some result, and they're not getting it, and that's the reason why I said from the beginning that from the community's point of view, sometimes you have to realize that we must treat the prosecutions as business and not as a hobby. And that means that we can't necessarily sit on the sideline and watch as justice is wasted away.
But the other officers so far, including those two who have basically not been convicted, they all say, well, it was up to Porter, William Porter, the driver of this van into which Freddie Gray was placed, shackled, belly down, on the floor of this vehicle. And they were not there. They were not in the back of the vehicle. They were not there at the time that Freddie Gray allegedly suffered these life-threatening and fatal injuries. They have nothing really to compel anybody to believe that they, too, believe that William Porter was actually responsible in some specific way for the death of Freddie Gray. All they could testify to was that they knew that Freddie Gray was in the back of the van. They knew that he was not placed in the van with a seatbelt. And they, in one case, they said, well, you should check on him and so forth. But there is nothing there, at least, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but there's nothing there, it seems to me, that definitively stands out as credible eyewitness testimony for either from the officers or from anybody else that says Freddie Gray is dead because A, B, C, D, and I saw it.
And you're absolutely right. And that's the reason why we said from the beginning, Treese, that this has to be a Nuremberg prosecution. And a Nuremberg prosecution in the sense that you really hammer at the superior officer in the case. You really hammer at what he did or did not do and let the chips fall where they may. But you got to have a villain in that group of six people. And to me, it would seem that the superior officer here would have been the villain rather than somebody who could wait until three or four other people have been acquitted before his number comes up. And that's where I think the real problem is, because you got to have somebody that you go after. I mean, there's just no way in the world. You got to have an enemy. You got to have a villain. You got to have somebody that, you know, people make easily conclude that, you know, that you're responsible for that. And I don't see this here. And the mere fact that Rice can wait to three or four officers down the food chain before his number comes up is very disturbing to me.
Nor do we see any discussion made about police practices that would make it reasonable for people to believe, well, this rough ride, as they said, that Freddie Gray got in the back of the van was well known within the police community as a technique for administering their own style of justice to people they deemed to be brought into line. And this was the way they dealt with people. This was a standard, established, long-established police practice of torture. I don't see that the case is going beyond, well, was it murder, who did it, and that kind of thing, which is expected in a case where you have to establish these things if you're going to charge people with depraved heart murder and manslaughter and so forth. But it doesn't seem as if the case also incorporates the support for these arguments about how police conducted their business in the course of arresting certain clients from certain communities.
Well, what you have here is what you had in Mississippi, and that was the death of Emmett Till caused by reckless eyeballing. I mean, essentially, the question becomes, why would somebody who is engaged in reckless eyeballing in Maryland end up in a slammer and on a gurney and dead? I mean, because basically that's what you have. I mean, I don't see anything that would suggest to me that somebody would put Freddie Gray through all of this because of what the superior officer, somebody else, may have seen from the outset. And I haven't seen where people are really focusing on that to really say, if it wasn't for Rice in this situation, who was responsible for the conduct of his own police officers, Freddie Gray would still be here among us. And it doesn't seem like nobody's trying to in any way harm Rice or implicate him in any way into what is happening. And that's why I think everybody's getting a free ride right now until finally he comes up. But by the time he comes up, we're going to be so conditioned to these cops getting off that he's going to be able to ride that on right out of the courtroom.
Well, I want to thank you, Alton, for this analysis today. Again, preliminary hearings are being held today as the trial begins in earnest tomorrow against Officer Porter, the driver of, Officer Caesar Goodson, the driver of the van in which Freddie Gray sustained lethal injuries that eventually claimed his life. So we'll see how that goes, and we will tackle more legal issues as it goes along. Thanks so much for being with us today and getting us started. Thank you, Alton.
Well, Trish, just let me say one thing, because I want to just say that, you know, as we are doing this, we have to realize that what the death of Michael Griffin was about in terms of the position that we took were actually done in memory of Muhammad Ali and Rosa Parks, because had not been for their refusal to cooperate with evil, then we may have never taken that stance ourselves. And so in that sense, you know, I'm very disturbed that we can start talking about the federal government getting involved in a case when we are actually already have an executive order from the state that should be enforced, that would enable this young man, like the Griffith family, to receive some semblance of justice.
Thank you for that. We now come to the second half of our program. As you know, Muhammad Ali, the world-renowned boxer and humanitarian, died this past Friday from respiratory complications associated with his battle more than three decades with Parkinson's disease. He was 74 years old. I want to share with you a clip. This is Muhammad Ali appearing on Face the Nation. And the reason I want to share this is you want to listen to the attitude of the questioners, George Herman and Fred Graham, both of CBS News, and Peter Bonventry of Newsweek. Listen to the tone and focus of their questions, but listen to the masterful response by Muhammad Ali. This was done on May the 2nd, 1976.
Said that you like to lecture better than you like to box. You've become certainly a very well-known world figure. People know about you in every corner of the earth. You say you want to be a sort of a black Henry Kissinger. What is it you want to do after you stop fighting?
Well, I figure that we only have so many hours a day to do whatever we have to do, so many years to live, and in those years we sleep about 8 hours a day, we travel, we watch television. If a man's 50 years old, he's lucky to say if he's had 20 years to actually live. So I would like to do the best that I can for humanity. I'm blessed by God to be recognized as the most famous face on the earth today, and I cannot think of nothing no better than helping God's creatures or helping poverty or working for good causes where I can use my name to do so, to help this country in other countries where we're having various problems where my influence might help.
Muhammad, what do you think you would have become if you didn't get into boxing?
I really don't know. I started boxing at 12 years old. I was not that educated in school, and I don't know what I would have done. Probably a factory worker, could have been somewhere dead, wound up in the wrong game, the wrong life. But if I had heard the Islamic teachings, and if I've heard the Muslim teachings, and which I've accepted, I would have probably been a minister doing something else good for mankind, but not in a larger way.
Mr. Ali, let me explain. I'm the law correspondent here at CBS, and they didn't bring me in because there might have been something illegal to ask you about, but because they learned that I'd been a Golden Glovers once in the dim past. And I want to ask you a sort of a Walter Mitty-ish question. Is there ever going to be another great white hope, a white heavyweight that's going to come in and whip all of you black heavyweights?
Well, it's a great possibility. We can't foresee him now. Like, they come up. We might have one now who might come out of the next Olympics. One might be in some gymnasium now, and he'll knock out somebody next week. We never know until it happens.
Why are there so few American white fighters? You're going to fight a white man in Germany, but why are so few American white heavyweights?
I really don't know. One time we had Jack Dempsey, Gene Tooney, John L. Sullivan, Rocky Marciano, Max Baird, Tony Galento. We had good fighters. Carmen Basilio, Gene Fulman, and they're just not here now.
Well, then let me ask you about this Japanese wrestler. Isn't that denigrating your position as a champion to go over and take part in a gimmick like fighting a wrestler?
I would say ordinary champion, yes, but people expect these things of me. I have a great imagination. I'm always doing something. I don't think you've ever had a box on this show because the things that I've done calls for attention. So this is going to be, we're going into the Oriental world. There's things I want to do for people of the world, and I can get through them through sports, where when I'm out of boxing, they'll all know me. And now we're working on the Oriental part of the world for some things we like to do there, and we get to meet them through sports. Plus, it's, I have a family. I'm looking to take care of my family. It's a nice payday, and it's interesting. Many people want to know, what would a boxer do with a wrestler? And then they'll have a chance to see.
Well, now let me ask you about that nice payday. It seems to me that in February of 1975, you said all your fights from now on were going to be free, that you were going to give all the money to various black charities and to help small businesses and so forth. Does the money come to you, or is it going to these charities?
Not just black charities. We help all type charities, all type people, so I want to get that straight now. Yes, the monies that I make after all taxes, I say it. I like to do all I can to help people and work for charity groups. And I want to say this on the show now. I get millions of phone calls from people thinking I'm the First National Bank. We don't give away no monies. I have lawyers, I have attorneys who check the organizations, the movements, and we don't have no individuals in business that have propositions. It's only for groups of people who need, and this is what I want to do.
Was it lawyers and attorneys who went to that Jewish old people's home in New York where there was just about 50 people, or was it Muhammad Ali himself?
No, this was me. This was me. And things such as this, I almost don't have to get permission to help because we know this is right. There's no greed involved on no part of no individuals.
Muhammad, what would you say to your son if he came to you and expressed a desire to box?
Well, I think I'm going to control him or help my wife to control him, and that's to educate him first, get his mind together. And I wouldn't encourage him to box. I'll let him do it as a game, as a sport for health, but not as a livelihood because it's too dangerous. But teach him foreign language and get him. See, we all were born for a purpose. Every trees, the moon, rain, snow, everything God created has a purpose, and man has a purpose. And the wise man is he who finds his life purpose, and we want to help him find his purpose in life, which I'm sure is not boxing.
Are you worried about the burden he'll have to bear being the son of Muhammad Ali? I mean, you're a tough act to follow.
Well, if my act is not a good act, and if I'm not doing nothing right for people and if my image is bad, it'll be bad. But if I can do the things that I would like to do for God and the service of mankind, then I'm sure he'll be honored to be known as my son, and he would like to follow my footsteps, and people will admire him for that. But if my image is bad, then it's bad for him.
Can I go back to this question of money we were talking about before? By rough estimate, you've made almost $25 million in purses since you came back fight. Now, we've had the spectacle of some former champs who end up in the gutter. What are you doing to avoid that? Are you going to avoid that?
Yes, sir. I'm praying Almighty God, Allah, do. I think the best thing that I can do or anybody can do is to save the money.
And what's your money in, champ?
Government tax-free bonds is the best thing I think a man can put his money in. Investments are bad. There are no real good investments. All of them are gambles. And we pay the government all its taxes before I get mine. But this is why we fight so regular, because I think two halves is better than just one. So we plan to save as much as we can. And
well, you're a conservative, aren't you, champ? Government tax-free bonds, you're a pretty conservative man with your money.
Well, I have a lot of conservative fellows advising me.
let me ask you about something you said just a moment ago in reply to a question by Pete. You said, advising you, son, you would say boxing was too dangerous. Has it been dangerous for you? Have you been hurt? Have you been injured? Have you been damaged in any way?
My jaw's been broken, and one nerve is just coming back from under here where I couldn't feel for about a year or two. And right now, my eardrum is busted. I got my busted eardrum in Manila with Joe Frazier training for Frazier, and I just had it rebusted, the same one again, and it'll heal itself in about 2 weeks, but this is about all. I've had a few sore ribs.
I asked because there's been some belief in some quarters that boxing was a dying sport in the United States. I noticed it dropped out of a lot of schools and a lot of colleges. I'm told that now it's coming back in some colleges. What do you think of boxing as a sport for amateurs?
I think boxing is dangerous. Any man being hit in the head, the brain's a delicate thing. I think it should be well protected. If a fella's not qualified, he shouldn't be allowed to fight. But football is proven to have more deaths. Baseball, ice hockey, horse racing, car racing is much more dangerous. But I would advise nobody to box if they get hit too much and it's too dangerous.
Mohammed, since this is a political year, do you have a favorite among the presidential candidates? And more interestingly, has anyone asked you for support?
No, they haven't. Made a statement the other day about I'm not voting for no one. I don't know enough about politics, nor do I want people watching this show to be influenced by my feelings, because I don't know enough about it. But on this administration that I really have liked is Ford's administration. For simple fact, immediately after meeting George Foreman, I was invited to the White House and met him and his daughter. King Hussein was just in the country, and he thought enough of me, knowing that he was a Muslim. My religion, he thought enough of me to invite me to entertain him and to meet him at the White House. So I've been to the White House twice. So if I had to do any voting, which I don't know enough about politics, but I like President Ford and his administration.
Can I go back to the money just for a minute?
Just a moment. On this question of endorsing somebody, you have also said that you would vote for Jimmy Carter, have you not?
I mentioned no names.
Seems to me you were on record in a newspaper article as saying you would vote for Jimmy Carter.
I remember I said no name. I said there's a certain fellow, I just like his smile.
Well, were you put off by the ethnic purity remark that he made?
No, I don't know nothing about that. I don't condemn people for making remarks or making statements. I'm sure we all make statements off camera that would get us all in trouble. But because somebody made a mistake, I'm one who's been criticized for things I've said, so I'm the last one to condemn any man for something he said, because I'm a victim of the same circumstance.
Well, you leave us kind of hung up. You like Jimmy, you like a man with a certain smile, and you like President Ford.
I didn't say no name. I like your smile.
You like a man with a certain smile for president. You like President Ford. Are you going to vote for both of them?
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say I like him for president. I just said I like the image of a certain man. I like the way he smiles. I see all the politicians smiling. What make you think I mean Carter?
I pursue this for one particular reason. There's been a big problem lately in a diminished vote from the black segment of the American population. The blacks have not been voting in anywhere like their past strength. And so I wonder whether you, as one of the recognized figures of the black community, might give a push to black voting, or whether you think of this as important.
I think it's important if the man we vote for does the right job and means right for all people. I don't know too much about politics, so this is why Carter, Ford, or whoever, I cannot openly make a statement who I'm supporting or who I'll vote for, because I don't know. But the administration that I like, and the one I've been under a few presidents since I've been popular, but I've never been honored like I have by President Ford.
Well, you are. I know that you have more an interest in religion, and you've said that's one of the things you want to devote a lot of time to later. But now, Mr. Ali, what about this image also as a womanizer that you also have? Is that going to... You're looking at me a little incredulously here. I don't know why, but...
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by womanizer.
Well, you have a reputation as you're separated from your wife, and you have a reputation as a man who has a sharp eye for the ladies. Now, how is that going to be consistent with your role as a religious leader in the years ahead?
Well, as far as my personal beliefs are concerned, I don't talk about them in public. As far as my personal problems are with family, these are things I don't discuss in public, especially on high-class shows like I was told yours would be, so I don't even expect to talk about that here.
You have said from time to time that a wise man can play the fool, but a fool can't act like a wise man, and then you've said, I've always got to talk. People expect it of me. Is that a role that you play?
What I was talking about, I used to watch a wrestler named Gorgeous George, and he would always talk about how he's going to annihilate the bum, and he would do this and do that, and people came to see him get beat, and this is where I got the idea. So the talking and the gimmicks and the predicting, which I don't do nowadays like I used to, was only to promote the fights, which has now elevated me over all athletes in the history of the world as far as drawing power and world attraction is concerned. So this is just for purpose of publicity, all the talking. That's why I did that. I don't have to do it.
You kind of disappoint me, I have to admit. I sort of thought this poetry, this float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, was the real Ali, not some kind of a commercial gimmick.
No, that's all. It wasn't a commercial gimmick, but it was promotion, and it was the real Ali. I do float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, but the little poems and the gimmicks were just to promote the fights. To newspapers gave them something to write about.
If I can go back just for a minute, and this is obviously meant in a spirit of friendliness. The question of the Islamic religion and your future in that, the impression one gets is perhaps it is loosening up a bit after the death of Elijah Muhammad. Do you think it's changing now, and that your role in it can change in view
of what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught was good for the time during the 30s when black people had been castrated, lynched, deprived of freedom, justice, equality, raped. He had to teach that the white man is a devil. His actions towards us is that of a devil. Now that we're no longer being lynched, raped, castrated, we're given equal justice. We can go anywhere to live, even the North fights the South to have, so we can have certain rights. People are not acting this way today. So Honorable Wallace D. Muhammad is on time. He's teaching us it's not the color of the physical body that makes a man a devil. God don't look at our colors. Minds, hearts have no color. God look at our minds and our actions and our deeds. So we have white Muslims, brown Muslims, red Muslims, yellow Muslims, all colors. So it's the color. So the big thing in the change now, we have white people who have accepted our faith, and we now recognize all men as brothers, and we look at them according to their works. Some blacks can do evil and whites. So it's not the color. Now we look at the actions.
Now, how about the money, though? There have been reports that the Muslims, to a large extent, controlled and received a lot of your money. What truth is there to that?
There's no truth whatsoever. I wish I could give more to my cause than I do. Who receives most of my money is the American government. I have made about $31 million up until this time, and the government has taken about $28 million. So I don't have no money to give to my religion like I want to. The government has taken it. I'll make $1,500,000 for the fight I just had. I'll be doing good to go home with $350,000 out of $1,500,000 because of all the taxes and state and federal and the government. So the government will take the monies, not my religion.
Muhammad, in your book, The Greatest, there seems to be a great deal of revisionist history. You tell us that you weren't brought up in middle-class comfort but semi-poverty. You tell us you're not a direct descendant of Henry Clay, and you tell us it wasn't a white Louisville cop named Joe Martin who started you on boxing, but a black instructor in Louisville. And this flies in the face of all the research we've done over the past 15 years. How did we miss it?
Joe Martin was the man who I first started boxing with. Joe Martin is a white patrolman in Louisville, Kentucky, who held boxing at Columbia Gym. And he had a show called Tomorrow's Champions. Well, during that time, the blacks were a little held back. So Fred Stoner was the best trainer. Fred, I would train with Joe Martin at 8 o'clock and go to 10 o'clock and train with Joe Martin. That's where I learned, Fred Stoner. That's where I learned my science, my boxing ability, my dancing ability, all my skills. But I had to go back to Joe Martin in order to stay with him to get on the television, which he had the connections and the complexions to get the protections. So I stayed with him. But the man who actually trained me, to taught me my skills, was Fred Stoner. But the man who took me around the country, got me the publicity, and put me in the right places with Joe Martin. So this is how I had to make it in that southern city.
But what about you say you grew up in semi-poverty? And your father was a fairly successful
son. When I say semi-poverty, I mean many days we didn't have food, and many days we had to put cardboard in our shoes, and many days the car wouldn't start because it's always 15 years too old, and many days the toilet wouldn't flush because the plumbing was broke, or many days we had to put a pan under the roof because the water had leaked in the kitchen, we couldn't afford to fix it, or the cellar would fill up during rain and we had to take a bucket and put the water out. My mother and father did all they could, and with the monies they made, they raised me good, and this is why I'm as great as I am now, because of my mother and father and the help of God. So, and the way I never had to work, and they did all they could to feed me. So this is why I'm where I'm at. But semi-poverty compared to what I know and you know. We may go out tomorrow and spend $150 for dinner if we take three people. The average family in America today feeds a family 2 weeks on $150.
Were you ever asked during that period of time to throw a fight?
No, sir. I see this stuff in movies, but...
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Is that just in the movies, or is there a lot of that in
all
boxing?
All I know is from the movies. I've never had nobody say, throw a fight. I've never knew nobody who did. Now, probably in the past, these things have happened, but I know nothing about it.
You also report in the book that you threw your Olympic gold medal into the river after a couple of racist incidents. Do you regret that now? Do you wish you had the medal back now that the country has changed?
I wish I had my medal. I might try to go back and find that medal. Something happened to me one day, and I just got mad and threw the medal away.
Can I ask you one question about the Supreme Court decision? There was a report around the Supreme Court that the justices had first voted to uphold your conviction, and then later that they switched and it was unanimously to overturn it. Did you and your lawyers ever hear that rumor?
No, sir. I never heard that before.
Do you think that the system of justice dealt fairly with you?
Yes, sir. I know they have. I'll say this. We have a lot of moral problems in America, but America's the greatest country in the world. I've been throughout the world. The best schooling system, the best educational system, the medical system, the highways, the cars, the airplanes, the television shows. And this is why, but morally, we need to be uplifted. And the greatest moral teacher that we have in America is the Honorable Wallace D. Muhammad, and we are now looking to tell the people more about him.
Muhammad, let me bring a couple of questions out of left field. We talked about this once. Do you believe in life on other planets? And two, do you believe in reincarnation? And if you do, who would you come back as?
Yes, I believe in life. I believe there is. I'm not really sure. I don't think none of us can prove it, but I've heard the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teach that there's life on Mars. I believe, if I believe in reincarnation, I don't know. It was just a quick question, but I would like to come back as Wallace Muhammad, our great Muslim leader in America. To us, he's everything because he's teaching us all about ourselves, about God, how to treat people, how to eat, everything, my whole life, everything that I do, everything that I represent, all I think about when I'm fighting is the Honorable Wallace D. Muhammad and his program. He's the only man that I really admire, and I would like to come back as him.
Let me ask you one question, which I don't know whether it's out of left field or right field, about Muslims in America. One of the things that people think about is the conflict in the Arabic world between Muslims and Jews. Some people who are Jewish in this country get worried about black Muslims, and yet you show very little in the way of signs of anti-Semitism. It doesn't seem to be any parallel there.
No, well, I would like for you to look at me as a true one, as far as true belief is concerned. We don't have black Muslims here. That's a press word. We have white brothers. We have brown, red, and yellow. All colors can be Muslims. And as far as the conflict is concerned in those countries, I don't know too much about it. And I'm looking for peace one day with all people.
Now, Mr. Ali, you're obviously a very bright man, and yet we're told that at one time that you flunked the draft exam because of the mental test. Did you throw that? Was that one fight you threw?
Or was it fixed?
The reason I'm laughing is because it was true. I did fail it. Today, I'm not a good reader. I don't spell good at all. If you gave me a test today, I might fail it because we have 2 minutes to do the test. I told them after that, they said, Muhammad, you failed the test. I said, I told you I was the greatest, not the smartest.
Muhammad, they're going to go into filming on a movie based on your life, and you're supposed to be playing yourself. If you weren't the star, who would you like to play Muhammad Ali?
I really don't know. I would have to take some time to think about it, but it's real difficult because I can act. They say I'm a good actor, but nobody's never written lines to me and told me what to say and then look serious. So they've invested so much Columbia Pictures in this, and they really have a lot of faith, and I'm thankful for that, but they don't know if I can act or not yet.
Okay, thank you very much, Muhammad Ali, for being with us today on Face the Nation. And we'll have a word about next week's guest in a moment.
Well, there you go. Rather interesting, all the nuances of that interview. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program today. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.